Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Pico Iyer is the acclaimed and best-selling author of more than a dozen books translated into 23 languages. Most recently, The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise, and The Art of Stillness. His latest, A Flame, is an exploration of the abiding clarity and calm to be found in a quiet retreat. The book offers a mix of meditation and storytelling as Pico chronicles three decades of transformative stays at a tiny monastery in Big Sur, California. He ponders the stillness and the beauty that he finds in the monastery against the hard facts of any life, a house burning down, a parent dying, a daughter diagnosed with cancer. Pico Iyer is the author of A Flame, Learning from Silence, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him back to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's a delight and an honor. Thank you, Joe.
I've had this book in my possession for quite a while. I read it, and then I went to refamiliarize myself with it in the past week. And this, I'm sure, is no surprise to you, but this book reads very differently, given the Los Angeles fires, than it did when I first read it in the late summer of 2024. And yet, everything seems so up to date and important as to what you are saying here. And we'll get into the fire aspect, but just this idea of the title of the book being A Flame, which tells us so much about the point you're looking to make.
Yes, because unfortunately, that title is much too timely. So many places in the world, almost at any moment now. As you know, I lost my home and everything in the world here in the hills of California some years ago, and we rebuilt a house on the same property, and we've had to evacuate that house maybe 10 or 12 times. So a fire is a constant neighbor here.
How does that then figure into bringing you to the next step of silence, of looking for and seeking silence?
Well, I think we're all living in a time of acute uncertainty, partly because of natural disasters. So our question is how to live calmly when we don't know when the next fire or earthquake or flash flood is going to come through, and how can we live hopefully in the midst of impermanence and not knowing how long we'll have everything around them. And as you were saying in your introduction, I've learned a lot about confidence and cheerfulness from the Benedictine monks I've spent time around. But I think it's a question that we all have to face. You know, here in the hills of California, from which I speak to you, we know that the landscape can't survive without fire. So the question before us humans is, how can we live with fire? We can't wish it away, and it's going to make a visitation at some point. So how do we make our peace with that?
It is ultimately fire and leaving your home that brought you to the monastery in the first place.
Exactly. Because I was stuck in the middle of this forest fire for 3 hours. It was the worst fire in Californian history at the time. I was very lucky to escape with my life. And then, as you say, I was reduced to sleeping on a friend's floor for many, many months as my mother and I slowly reconstructed our lives. And at one point, another friend came in and he saw me on the floor and he said, "Come on, Pico, you can do better than this." And he told me about this retreat house 3.5 hours north up the coast. And he said, "You know, if nothing else, you'll have a bed to sleep in and a big desk and a private walled garden with this radiant view over the Pacific Ocean, hot showers, all the food you can eat for $30 a night. You'll be doing much better than sleeping on the floor." And so that's how I made my first reluctant almost retreat at this hermitage.
What was it about that setup that you felt planted a seed that allowed you to want to keep coming back again and again?
I think, oddly, it was instant liberation. So as I was driving up the narrow highway for 3.5 hours, as usual, I was conducting arguments in my head with faraway friends and fretting about my deadlines and worried about my poor mother back at home. And I drove up this narrow road to the top of the mountain where the retreat house sat and sits. And as soon as I got out of my car and I stepped into the silence which wasn't just an absence of noise. It felt like a presence of something, probably everything I sleepwalk past in the rest of my life. I felt complete release from my chattery mind. It was as if little Pico and all his thoughts and agitations was left down on the freeway, and now I was back in the calmest, clearest part of me. And the monks who organize this monastery and welcome 15 guests at any time wonderfully make no rules. They don't ask anything of you. They don't force you to do anything. They just know that sitting in this radiant setting in silence, whoever you are, whatever your religion or lack of religion, you will probably find what sustains you. And that's what I found. You know, I've been lucky enough to travel the world a lot, but I'd never found somewhere that left me both as joyful and as calm as this place.
For you, it is a lack of religion, correct?
It is. So what touches and amuses me is I'm not a Christian, I'm not affiliated with any religious group, and yet these deeply Catholic monks open their hearts and doors to everybody and treat me as if I were one of them.
You write about this in the book that you were someone who was always wanting excitement and action. So then to find silence, you have to go to a place to achieve it and to find it. And then once you find it, you can still have silence, but then you have to quiet all that's going on in your head.
Yes. I mean, I think the silence I found in the monastery in the larger picture, seeing everything in the light of eternity instead of the clock, changed the way I think of everything. So even, you know, most of my life, like everybody, I'm driving along the freeway from the bank to the pharmacy to the supermarket, and my monkey mind is chattering away. But just to know that there's another and a deeper reality and self not so far away, just to know that there's medicine nearby, puts everything in a different perspective. But if there isn't medication, you think, how am I ever going to get out of this? And having retreated to this place more than 100 times over 33 years, I think the reason that I wanted to bring out a book now was partly because I've never seen the world as divided as it is right now, and partly because I've never seen my friends so despairing as right now. And insofar as they're despairing, I thought, well, this is a place that's given me a great sense of confidence and hope, and maybe it's the best thing I could share.
Do you feel that despair as well?
I don't, oddly. And it's interesting because it's very topical, too, that this monastery, which is in the remote wilderness of Big Sur, is regularly encircled by flames, and the monks are having to race for their lives to evacuate. And usually, when that happens, two or three of them stay back to help the firefighters protect their home. And I remember a couple of years ago, the prior was staying back to try to save his monastery, and he would send daily updates to concerned friends like myself. And one day he said, "We can see smoke everywhere. The flames were about 200 yards away from us. They're just rearing up over the ridge behind the monastery. But don't worry, we're continuing our vigils and our vespers and our matins. We're maintaining our regular routine. Blessed day all. Blessed day all," he wrote, on a day when it looked like he could lose his life and his home. And so when I see that degree of confidence, it comes from faith in part, but it also comes from something deeper that maybe we can develop. And so I realize that we don't have to be despairing. You know, the monks have taught me that joy is the happiness that doesn't depend on circumstance, because all of us have difficult lives, monks as much as the rest of us, but still they can find joy even when their lives are in peril and things are very uncertain. And as you probably know, I've been lucky enough to spend 50 years talking and traveling with the Dalai Lama, and he's
Right.
exactly the same. I think he's probably suffered more than anybody I know. And when we think of him, what we think of is that infectious smile and his constant laugh and his robust confidence. So they've given me a model of how not to feel despair, even when life is very difficult.
Pico Iyer is the author of the new book, A Flame, Learning from Silence. The Dalai Lama writes about the book, reading A Flame may help many to lead lives of greater compassion and deeper peace of mind. When you would go to the monastery, the creativity that those moments would unleash for you, those moments were more for you than they were for your quote unquote work, right? They weren't so much for the deadline or for the new book or new article that was coming out, that they were moments for you.
That's perfectly said, Joe. Exactly. It's probably the only place in my life where I allow myself not to write. As you say, it's the most stimulating place I know. So when I go there, all I can do is scribble, scribble, scribble. Even if I had nothing to write about on the way up. But I came to see that everything I'm writing there is almost too calm and above the clouds. It has the sound of somebody whispering to himself in an empty room, probably because it is somebody whispering to himself in an empty room. So although I write a lot when I'm there, as you say, none of it goes out into the world. And it's really a place for me to think about what I should write and what I could write when I go back into my regular life.
Does that give you a freedom because it's not going out, that it is your inner thoughts that without that guiding you of saying, well, someday someone else will read this, that does give you a freedom and allows you to erase a lot of the perhaps barriers or guardrails that would be there otherwise?
Well, yes. I mean, what I write there is akin to journal entries. So it's very free of self-consciousness, and I know it's not going to get anywhere else. But I think more than that, all of us, especially if we're writing, need time away from the writing just to be able to put it into perspective and to think about what we need to write. And I'm a bit of a fanatic. In other words, every day of the rest of my life, I wake up and I go to my desk at probably 5 in the morning and I start writing, writing, writing. And that's a good thing to do, to have that discipline. But I sometimes am imprisoned in it and I need to step away from it just to be able to bring a clear eye to it. So the monastery is really a chance for me to get away from my life, to remember what matters and to remember what I care about. And in this case, to remember what I ought to write about.
You write in the book, retreat, I'm coming to find, is not so much about escape as redirection and recollection. You learn to love the world only by looking at it closely in the round. Did you feel that way almost immediately, or is that something that came over time?
Surprisingly, I did feel it immediately. My very first day and my very first stay, I instantly thought, this is the place I'm looking for all my life. I think it's as if many of us know the sensation of suddenly meeting somebody and feeling, that's the person for me, or that's the person I've known forever. And so many of my friends have gone to that place, and they haven't, it hasn't always agreed with them. Each one of us has to find our own place. But I was lucky that this happened to be the place that instantly made me feel at home and made me feel that I was back in my best self.
When you look at this book in comparison to some of your other work, is that a progression for you? Do you see that as a progression?
Thank you. I think of it as a distillation. You know, the older I get, the shorter the books I'm writing, but I hope the richer are the books I'm writing. So when I was in my 20s, if I talked to you for 30 minutes, when I finished, I'd write a 6-page account of my talk with Joe. Now, after talking to you, if I were to write about it, I'd probably write 6 lines. And my hope is there'd be more in those 6 lines than in 6 pages. So in this case, over the 33 years I've been spending in this hermitage, because I write so much there, I probably accumulated 4,000 pages of notes. And then the joy and adventure of writing the book was to try and compress it into almost a haiku, into something as short as possible, where every word counted and where I hope the reader can feel the explosions in each word, but also the silence that the reader herself will complete. So I think, I hope it is a progression in the sense of making things shorter and shorter and shorter and closer to the bone.
Do you think when it comes to silence that we have to go somewhere to find it in the sense of we have to relocate ourselves to be able to find a place that will allow us the permission, if you will, to learn from silence?
Yes, we probably don't have to, but most of us need to. So, for example, the house where my family had been living sits at exactly the same elevation as the monastery. It's a beautiful house, 1,200 feet over the Pacific Ocean, with a view of the sea down below. Anybody looking at it would say, this is the last word in tranquility and remoteness. But when I'm at home, I never stop to watch the light on the water because I can hear the phone ringing inside. And if I'm tempted to take a walk under the stars, I think, no way, I've got 100 emails I could be answering. So all the beauty and the wonder of the world is there, but I'm not there and I'm never paying attention to it. So in that sense, as soon as I go to this actually quite similar location, because I'm freed of distractions, because there's no internet and television and phone reception, suddenly I'm wide awake. And I notice the things that usually I'm not noticing sufficiently. So in that sense, I think that's why people go on hikes and that's why people travel, to take the lens cap off their eyes and suddenly be made aware of what's always there, but we usually can't see.
Because that external world, as you write, is so intense right now that every once in a while we have to realize that what is inside of us and what we're thinking is getting drowned out by all of the stuff in that external world.
Exactly. I mean, as you said earlier, I'm not part of a religious community, but I don't want to lose my inner life. And I do feel my inner life is in danger of being drowned out as 600 notifications come into us every morning. And so we really need to do something radical and dramatic to break this vicious cycle whereby we're in such a hurry we can't even notice what a hurry we're in. And I think, my fundamental question for myself is, what do I have to bring to the ICU when my loved ones are in the intensive care unit or when I am there? What's going to help me? And one day, while I was writing this book, suddenly I received a call that my mother had had a stroke, and there she was, teetering between life and death in the ICU for 35 days. And as I sat next to her, I thought, my bank account is not going to be of much help here. My resume is useless. Even all the books I've written are not much help. The only thing I can bring to my mother and to myself is whatever I've gathered within my inner savings account. And that savings account is only replenished, I find, when I'm in silence and when I'm being quiet. When I'm racing down the freeway in rush hour traffic, I'm not really helping my inner savings account.
So what is in that savings account? I mean, is that a calmness? Is that a, to relate to an earlier title of yours, a stillness, a place where you can dwell on, I assume, emotion and memory and things that help, and yes, silence, but also to help you find a calm.
Calm, clarity, and most of all, the larger picture. Again, I remember once when my father, at a relatively young age, suddenly was taken into hospital and died. And as an only child, I had to look after my mother and organize a memorial service and contact all the friends and family. It was a very busy time. And at one point, I realized the only thing I could to do was, when my mother was looked after, drive 3.5 hours up the coast and just sit on that monastery road for 2 hours in silence, remembering what outlasts our hopes, what survives even when we don't, this vast sky, the ocean in front of me, the sound of the bells tolling as they've been tolling for 1,000 years. So I just sat there for 2 hours and then I came back. And it put everything in perspective. It seemed, again, the best medicine I could find. So, yes, I think calm and clarity is exactly the best way to describe what I'm trying to gather to deal with the many times when reality is going to make a house call.
Let me add another word, which is another C word, which is communication. Do you feel you were communicating with your mother?
Yes. I suppose another way to put it was, I never expected when I first started going on retreat that spending this time in silence was really a gateway to a richer sense of community and compassion. I love being by myself. I am an only child, as I said, and as a writer, I spend every day most of my time at my desk. So it was heaven to be in this beautiful setting above the ocean with no responsibilities. But the longer I stayed, the more I saw that actually I was never alone, and it was only by being in solitude that, yes, I could think more about my mother and what I could bring to her. And it was only by being alone there that I actually decided to get married. And so the funny thing when I think back on it is that it was traveling into silence and solitude that taught me how to try to be a better friend and a better son, and how to try to bring more to the people around me in my daily life. Because, of course, that's what the monks are doing. I'm sitting in silence, but in their enclosure, when I stay with them, they're working round the clock to look after each other and also to take care of their 15 guests.
Does that make you a better listener?
Oh, what a beautiful question. I hope so, because I feel that even now, the part of me that's talking is the least interesting part. And the part that me is listening is the one relatively free of ego. And that's where the writer resides. I'm so happy you asked that question, because just this morning I woke up and I wrote something in my diary about how a writer is somebody who listens principally, who's not necessarily a talker, but who is sufficiently curious about the world and interested in the world that she or he wants to listen to everything. So you're right. I think maybe going up to that silence has taught me to listen more, and to that extent has taught me to be a better person and maybe a better writer.
Pico Iyer is our guest. The name of the new book is A Flame, Learning from Silence. In the realm of teaching, I'm interested in the monks themselves. You have lasting bonds with many of them, and they are a group that really take you in. There is the actual act of the silence and being at the monastery, but there's also their teachings as well, correct?
Correct. Their teachings give them that absolute confidence, and their vow of obedience is very moving to me, because what I came to see was it means not just obedience to their God, but obedience to one another, obedience to the prior, obedience to looking after other of their brothers with whom perhaps they never otherwise would have chosen to live. And so it's a very moving example of absolute service and selflessness. And as you say, when the retreat rooms are full, they allow me to stay with them. And so I get a very close-up view of both how talented they are and how hard they work to look after others. And I think one of the beauties of going there was it freed me from many of the preconceptions I had about monks. And the first was that the monks I know, I think of them as my homies. As you say, I've grown old with them over 33 years. But they're much less dogmatic than I and my friends are. They are absolutely open to everybody who comes to their door. They're also very down to earth. They're not at all pious. And they're just committed to loving their neighbors, whoever their neighbors might be. And so just to witness that example teaches me, I hope, how to be a slightly better person when I descend and return to my hectic life.
While answering that question, you used two words that I found fascinating, which were absolute confidence. Man, that seems like the hard part.
It seems to most of us like the impossible part, exactly. And yet, as I mentioned, there they are in the middle of the fire, never wavering. Once. And it, also, to speak of the monks is to go back to your earlier question when you were asking about the progression in my writing. Because what I notice with the monks is that when I pass them along the road, they say very little, maybe just one sentence, but it's very deep. And that one sentence stays with me more than the 16 paragraphs I'll probably hear from a friend this afternoon. That you can sense all the silence that lies between the words. And even when I'm walking along the road and I meet another person on retreat, a stranger, we'll talk for about 2 minutes. And it feels to me a richer exchange than any I'm likely to have when I'm back in my regular life. Partly because, as you said earlier, we're listening to each other. And in that silence, every sentence from a monk or another fellow traveler just reverberates and stays inside you. And it's a great freedom from distraction. I find my life is much too full of clutter, and my head is much too full of clutter these days. So to go there and just to hear a few sentences every day and to live with those sentences is a beautiful liberation.
I hope you agree with this statement. I don't know that you do, but it struck me in reading the book that while you are there, that you are also interested in why others are there. And the journalist in you really never goes away. What brings someone else other than yourself to be in this place in this time?
Yeah, I think that's partly true. But I think one of the things that so moves me is that at some level, everybody there is going, I think, for the same reason, which is seeking calm and clarity and freedom from their distracted regular selves. Many of the people there are lawyers and executives and real estate salespeople. And what I find is that when I walk along the road and I pass a stranger and we talk for 2 minutes, it's also a much richer exchange than the one I usually have because we're not talking about our jobs or where we went to school or the other ways we define ourselves. We're talking about something very close to the heart. And we're joined by something much more important than where we went to college or what we're doing for a living, because we're joined by the fact we've both come here for silence. And so I find that even the strangers I meet along the road quickly feel like some of my closest friends. And I am interested in drawing out their stories, but what I'm most interested in is the fact that we're defined by all that we share, not by what divides us, and that everyone there feels like kin, really. There are no strangers along that road.
Have the monks read the book?
Well, wonderfully, this is one of the reasons I love them. I sent the manuscript to two of them because, of course, they're pledged to anonymity, and I didn't want to trespass or divulge secrets or get things wrong. So I sent the manuscript to two of them and said, please tell me anything I shouldn't be saying or any place where I'm intruding. And the one who really shared his doubts and his fears and his frustrations with me wrote back instantly and said, please don't change a word. It's our brokenness. That's what we have to contribute. It's the fact we are human and imperfect and full of doubts. That's what we have to share. That we're not above the clouds. We don't know everything. We're not always confident. And that's the example we have to give with everybody else who's in much the same state. So I was very touched by that. And it reminded me of one reason I respect them so much, that they're not up in the clouds by any means.
I was struck by that in the book, that idea of embracing that brokenness.
They embrace the brokenness in themselves, in the world, and in everybody who visits. And I think they have a very keen sense of vulnerability, which makes for this beautiful intimacy. Again, I feel I trust them in a way that I don't trust, everybody I meet in my life.
Pico Iyer's latest is A Flame, Learning from Silence. It is published by Riverhead. I wish you great peace, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, it's really a delight to talk to you, and thank you for reading the book twice. The ultimate gift. Thank you.
Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.